I want to start today with a number that is honestly, it's hard to wrap your head around in this context. $5 million.
It is a massive number.
It is. And usually when we're looking at a sum like that in the sources we cover, we're talking about, a Series A funding round or maybe the cost to build a library wing.
Right, or a very, very generous endowment to a university to get your name on a building.
Exactly. But in the documents we were diving into today, that $5 million isn't a donation. And it is not the cost of the building itself.
No.
It's a tuition bill.
A tuition bill that one man paid to what we might call the university bureaucratic reality.
And this is the premise of today's deep dive. We are looking at a fascinating and frankly terrifying stack of documents from an author and developer named Carlos Giardino.
Right?
He's written a series of books, specifically one called The $5,000 Tuition Book and another titled Missing Middle No Bullshit.
And the titles really set the tone here, don't they? This is not a polite architectural digest.
Not at all. This is a manual for survival. The core idea is that Giardino spent $5 million, not on bricks, not on land, not on fancy architects, but on learning how to navigate the invisible friction of building housing in a city that claims to want it.
That distinction is the most important takeaway here. We're not talking about the rising cost of lumber or concrete.
No.
We are talking about the sunk cost of learning the unwritten rules. This is a forensic accounting of failure and success. We're moving from the myth of the housing crisis to the mud of reality.
The mud, that's where we're going today.
Right.
Our mission is to unpack this tuition. We're going to look at why a simple fourplex can destroy a family's net worth.
And how Giardino turned that $5 million loss into a machine that actually works. It's a journey from being a hero, trying to build one house, to building a factory that builds systems.
And it all starts with a very specific address.
It does.
All right, let's get straight into the crime scene. 12 Batavia Avenue.
12 Batavia. This is the perfect example of what the source material calls the trap.
So set the scene for us. You have a developer, Giardino. He's not a novice. He's got an engineering background, finance background.
Right.
He comes to 12 Batavia with a plan to build missing middle housing. That's the gentle density everyone talks about. And here is the kicker that jumped out at me immediately.
The cash.
He had $4 million in cash.
Cash. That is the key detail. This wasn't a developer begging a bank for a loan. This wasn't someone waiting for subsidies. This was unencumbered liquid capital sitting in a bank account ready to go.
So logically, you'd think
Yeah.
the city has a declared housing crisis. A guy has money and land and wants to build housing.
Yeah.
The city should be rolling out the red carpet, right?
You would think logic dictates that.
But the city stopped the project not for a week, not for a month,
For how long?
for 25 months.
25 months, that's over 2 years of capital just sitting there.
25 months of capital sitting idle. Now, you have to ask yourself why. I mean, was the building unsafe?
No.
Was it structurally unsound? Was it going to fall over?
No, the engineering was solid. It was stopped because the city planning staff said they were uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable. That is such a loaded word. It's so subjective, like they would try on a pair of shoes or something.
It is the death knell of development. See, comfort isn't a policy. You can't look it up in the building code. But at 12 Batavia, comfort became the barrier.
And the source material highlights this staggering comparison.
It does. On the exact same street, a neighbor applied to build two units in a laneway. They got approved.
Okay, so density was allowed on the street. It wasn't a blanket, no.
Theoretically. But Giardino applied to build four proper homes in the front, plus two laneway units. Cleaner, safer, better engineered, and got rejected.
So why the double standard? If the neighbor can build in the laneway, why couldn't he?
Because the neighbor's project didn't look like a precedent. It was a one-off. Giardino's project looked like a replicable solution. And in the world of municipal planning, a replicable solution can be terrifying because it might upset the status quo.
The sources suggest they were worried about local elections, about NMBY complaints.
Exactly. They were managing political risk, not housing supply.
So while they debated their feelings and checked the political winds, what happened to the actual project?
Well, inflation ate the budget, and the incoherence tax just piled up.
The incoherence tax. I love that phrase, even though it hurts to hear it. Can you define that for us?
It's the invisible cost you pay for bureaucratic confusion. It's the cost of time, legal fees, holding costs, all while you try to interpret rules that are applied inconsistently.
And there's a statistic in the documents that it actually made my jaw drop.
Oh, I know the one you're talking about. The neighbor got approved with one application.
One, and for 12 Batavia.
The city system logged 477 bureaucratic entries.
477?
Yes. That's not 477 homes. That's 477 emails, status changes, revision issued, issuance pending, meeting deferred. That is the tax in action.
It creates a situation where the only way to escape is to just retreat.
And that's what happened, right? They didn't build the multiplex.
No. They eventually had to retreat and build a single large house just to get out of the trap. Think about the absurdity of that.
It's maddening. The city effectively forced a developer who wanted to build density to build a mansion instead, because they were uncomfortable with the housing they claim they want.
It really busts the myth that developers just don't want to build middle housing. Sometimes they literally aren't allowed to. But okay, so that's the permission trap.
Right.
But let's say you actually get the permission. You survive the comfort test. Then you walk right into what Giardino calls the ambush.
The ambush is financial, and it's hidden in the sequencing of the paperwork. This is where the tuition really gets expensive.
This is the stuff that nobody tells you in architecture school.
Not at all. We're talking about development charges or DCs. These are fees developers pay to the city to help pay for infrastructure, sewers, roads, parks.
Seems fair enough, right? New people need new pipes.
In theory, yes. But here's the secret rule that cost Giardino hundreds of thousands of dollars to learn. Development charges aren't based strictly on your impact on the grid. They are based on the order in which you file your papers.
Break that down. How does the order of paper change the price of a sewer hookup?
Okay, so look at the math. Imagine you're building a multiplex, say a main house with four units and a garden suite in the back.
Okay.
If you file permit A for the main house before permit B for the garden suite, the city categorizes the project in a way that triggers full fees. You might owe $660,000.
$660,000 just in fees. That's the price of a whole house in some places.
Correct. But if you file permit B before permit A, or you structure the demolition permit in a very specific way, you trigger an exemption.
And you pay what?
You pay zero.
Wait, zero versus $660,000 for the exact same building.
The exact same bricks,
yeah.
The exact same toilets flushing into the exact same sewer. The impact on the city is identical. The only difference is the sequence of the stack of paper on a bureaucrat's desk.
That is the tuition. That is what you pay $5 million to figure out. Because surely the city doesn't just tell you that.
Of course not. They assume you know the rules, even when the rules make no sense. And if you don't know that rule, you pay the 660 grand, and that blows up your budget.
And when the budget blows up, the project stalls. Which leads us to the story of 50 Castleton.
Right. 50 Castleton. This paints such a grim picture in the book. It's described as a house just left to rot.
It's a visceral image. Walls opening up, water intrusion, debris. To a neighbor, it looks like a slumlord who ran out of money.
An eyesore. But the reality was the opposite. They had the money, they had the desire to build. But the city had locked them in what Giardino calls iteration hell.
Meaning they were forbidden from even touching the property.
Exactly. While the bureaucracy cycled through reviews, Giardino calls this compliance. The rot wasn't neglect. The rot was the physical manifestation of regulatory paralysis.
Oh, so you have money burning, buildings rotting, and arbitrary fees that swing by $500,000 based on paperwork order. At this point, most people would just quit. I know I would quit.
Well, if people do, or they go bankrupt.
But this is where the story pivots. This is why we're talking about this today. Giardino didn't quit.
No. He stopped trying to be a hero, fighting every battle individually. He realized that to survive this environment, you can't just build houses.
You have to build a machine.
You have to build a machine.
This brings us to Act Three. The factory. And I love this part because it's where we get into the how. The solution isn't just working harder, it's industrialized geometry.
And importantly, before we get to what this is, he explicitly dismisses the trendy solution everyone loves to talk about.
Modular housing.
Modular housing. Yeah, putting shipping containers together. You see it on every design blog.
So why doesn't that work here?
Logistics. It sounds great on paper. But in a dense old city, you have hydro wires, narrow streets, mature trees. You physically cannot swing a 40-foot box into a backyard without shutting down the whole neighborhood.
Right. You'd be cutting down the trees you're trying to save just to get the house in place.
Plus, when you ship a module, you are mostly paying to ship air. You're shipping an empty room. It's just inefficient.
Okay. So if not boxes, what?
Components. The Silk Road strategy. Giardino set up a supply chain coming out of the Republic of Georgia.
Georgia. That seems very specific.
It is. It's a strategic choice. High-tech manufacturing, lower labor costs, and a good location for logistics. Instead of shipping empty rooms, they ship the high-value pieces flat-packed. Triple-glazed windows, cabinetry, facades.
And this is where the math gets really cool. They standardized everything to just 3 window sizes.
2 foot, 3 foot, 4 foot. That's it.
But doesn't that make every house look the same, like a Soviet block or something?
You'd think so, but the math says otherwise. From those 3 chassis components, they can generate 884,736 unique combinations.
That is wild. Almost 1 million combinations from 3 window sizes.
It's the Lego principle. You only have a few types of bricks, but you can build the Death Star or a castle. And because they're manufacturing these in Georgia, they get German-level quality for prices that local Canadian suppliers just can't touch.
And speed. That was the other big factor the sources mentioned.
Huge factor. If you order high-end windows in Canada right now, you are waiting 16 weeks. Maybe more.
And if they arrive wrong, you're dead in the water.
Absolutely. Giardino's supply chain. Manufacturing takes 2 weeks. Shipping takes 4 weeks. Total is 6 weeks.
So they are beating local suppliers by months and on price.
It's what Giardino calls the McDonald's of the missing middle.
Now, hold on. McDonald's isn't usually a compliment in architecture.
Yeah.
We usually associate that with, you know, cheap, unhealthy stuff.
He clarifies that. It's not because the food is cheap. It's because of the certainty. When you order a fry at McDonald's, you know exactly what you are getting.
Right.
When you build a missing middle house using this system, you know exactly what the components are, when they arrive, and how they fit. You remove the variable of, I wonder if the window fits. You remove the friction.
So they built the machine. They pay the tuition to learn the rules. Now, let's see it in action. Does it actually work in the real world?
This brings us to 5 Knight Street. The victory.
This is the proof of concept. So they go to 5 Knight Street, they have the plan, and sure enough,
it's a city tries to spring the trap again.
Of course.
They tried to hit them with the development charges, the $660,000 ambush we talked about.
But this time, they had the playbook.
Exactly. They didn't argue. They didn't beg for an exemption. They just used the tuition. They reordered the permits. They secured the primary 6-plex building first, layered the garden suite second. They followed the exact sequence.
And the result.
0 development charges on the main house. The project was built. It is occupied. It is cash flowing.
They didn't need the city to be generous.
They just forced the city to follow its own inconsistent rules.
That is incredibly satisfying. It turns the bureaucracy into just another engineering constraint, like gravity or soil quality. You can't negotiate with gravity. You just build around it.
Precisely. And that leads to the biggest realization of all in these books. If this is how hard it is for a professional team with millions of dollars and an international supply chain, what chance does a normal person have?
This is the part that really hits home for me. We need to talk about Joe and Maria.
Joe and Maria, they are the proxy for the listener, or maybe the listener's parents.
Yeah, picture them for us.
Longtime homeowners. They live on a good street. Their land is worth millions on paper because the market has gone crazy. But they are house poor.
Right. They're worried about the roof leaking, paying property taxes out of their savings. They are asset rich, cash poor.
And they are sitting on a winning lottery ticket, their land, but it's also a landmine field.
That is the perfect metaphor. The industry tells Joe and Maria, unlock your equity, build a laneway suite, become a developer.
And Giardino's advice to them is stark. Do not do it.
Don't do it.
Do not DIY. The expert warning here is crystal clear. If Joe and Maria try to develop a 6-plex themselves, they are gambling their family's entire net worth against a bureaucracy that does not care if they go bankrupt.
You can just imagine it. It's 3 in the morning. There's a hole in the backyard. The shoring is failing. The city just issued a stop work order because of a permit error Joe didn't even know existed.
It's a nightmare scenario. So the book proposes a different model. The partnership.
How does that work?
Joe and Maria provide the land. That's the scarce resource. The Machine Giardino's company provides the system, the capital, and the execution.
So Joe and Maria don't have to hire the architect or fight the city?
No. They trade a rotting, cash-draining asset, the old house that costs them money every year, for a share in a modern income-producing building. They stay in their neighborhood. They just lose the risk.
That sounds like a dream, but it relies on the money behind it. You need deep pockets to weather that incoherence tax. And the sources make a big distinction here between cowboy money and boring money.
This is critical. Cowboy money is what you usually find in development. It's impatient. It wants 20% returns immediately.
It wants the quick flip.
Exactly. And that creates pressure. pressure to cut corners, or worse, pressure to sell the building the moment it's finished. If Joe and Maria partner with cowboy money, they might get forced out of their own legacy.
And boring money.
Boring money, which is what the financial arm View LPI describes itself as, is patient. Think pension funds. It's designed for long-term holds. It wants steady cash flow over 20 or 30 years, not a quick score.
For Joe and Maria, boring money is a safety feature.
It means the goal is to build a high-quality building that lasts 50 years, not something that just looks good on a spreadsheet for 6 months.
Cash first, pride later.
That's the motto. And it sums up the entire philosophy. You can't have pride in the architecture if you run out of cash in the permitting phase. You have to survive the friction first.
It really reframes the whole housing conversation. We always hear about greedy developers or NMBY neighbors, but this paints a picture of a system that is just broken, mechanically broken.
It is a machine that manufactures friction, and the only way to beat it is to build a better machine. The $5 million tuition wasn't just lost money, it was the R&D budget for that better machine.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the tuition of friction, we've gone from the trap of 12 Batavia to the factory of industrialized geometry all the way to the victory at 5 Knight Street.
It's a journey from frustration to engineering.
I want to leave the listener with a thought. We talked about 12 Batavia where $4 million sat idle and nothing got built. How many other Joe and Marias are out there right now?
Thousands.
Thousands of lots. Thousands of potential homes all sitting locked up because the tuition to unlock them is just too expensive for a normal person to pay.
It raises a profound question. If we really want to solve the housing crisis, do we need more money, or do we just need to stop charging people $5 million to learn the rules?
That is the question. The book is The $5,000 Tuition Book by Carlos Giardino. It's a sobering look at the reality behind the blueprint. Thanks for exploring the mud with us today.
Always a pleasure to dig into the details.
We'll catch you on the next deep dive.